Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning and welcome to Spirit Mornings. I'm Bruce McGregor. She is
Chris McGregor.
And today, Chris, again, we are delighted to be joined by Mike Aquilina, Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Mike has authored or edited more than a dozen books on Catholic history, doctrine, and devotion, including, of course, the best-selling What Catholics Believe and The Grail Code, among so many more. Mike, also a very regular contributor here on the program as we talk about church fathers, or the fathers of the church, if you will. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Bruce. Good to be back.
Mike, I love the expanded edition of the Fathers of the Church.
She does.
It makes me happy.
Well, thank you. I broke the spine already, though. I'm going to have to...
That's a record. You must be getting some good use out of it.
It is. You know, I really think that this could be used as a very easy textbook for maybe, say, an RCIA group or Bible studies or groups or just people that are trying to learn more because, you know, the way you write, it makes it so easy for us to understand complicated things, but you also make it very, you know, you have lots of footnotes and I just think it's perfect.
Well, the footnotes are new. Originally, I wrote it for exactly the audience you're talking about, Chris. I wrote it for a general audience, a popular audience, and it ended up being used at a lot of universities and colleges as a textbook, too, because they found it useful that way. So I went back and added all the footnotes later for the second edition.
And it occurred to me the other day that we're almost at a year now that we've started talking about the fathers, and I was so glad the expanded edition came out because there's a whole bunch of other fathers in there we haven't talked about.
Wonderful.
And mothers. So we keep going.
That's right. We can keep this going for a long time.
Today we're going to talk about St. John of Damascus.
What a timely topic.
Well, how about that?
Topic, and what an attractive guy.
He's one of my heroes because when I was a liturgist and we were designing churches and doing different things, I really started learning about the icon. Mm-hmm. And he is a hero, not just of the icon, but how art expresses God's creation and why it's okay to try to picture him in art.
Well, you're right about that. He really did give us the first theology of the icon. What are we up to when we use images of the divine in our worship? He was the first one really to do that, but he was so much more than that, too.
Mm-hmm.
He really was a systematic theologian in the way that the later theologians were, the medieval theologians. Some people call him the first scholastic theologian. He is the border, really, between the patristic era and the scholastic era. He's almost a transitional figure. But in addition to all of that, he was a great preacher, and we have his homilies, and he was a songwriter. As a matter of fact, the Orthodox liturgy really emphasizes him as a hymn writer more than as a theologian or anything else.
And he smashes the idea that if you're good with numbers, you can't be good with art.
That's absolutely true, because he was a number cruncher. He was a bean counter. He was the chief financial officer for the caliphate of Damascus, the Islamic government in Damascus. Immediately after the rise of Islam, his grandfather had been the chief financial officer for the first caliph, and then his father was after him, and then John was in turn. So yeah, he was a bean counter, and he was also an artist. He was an amazing guy, very versatile.
Yeah, and as you point out, at a time in history where so many things were happening to the church and affecting the church, like the rise of Islam, approximately in the 700s.
Yes, we're looking at, with John, he was born, well, about 676. We don't really know when, and he died in the late 700s. According to all of the early lives of John, he was over 100 years old when he died. So he had a long and productive life. But he was born in Damascus at the time of the rise of Islam, and of course there were the theocratic governments there. That at first were very, very tolerant of Christianity. So John grew up in a wealthy family, a privileged family, a very cultured family, and he had a tremendous education. His best friend and early playmate was the son of the caliph. Mm. So John showed us, you know, by his early life that there is a precedent and there is a possibility of this interreligious peace, this interreligious cooperation, because the families were very close. And obviously the working relationship was very close, but there was no compromise on religion between his family, which was a very prestigious Christian family, the Mansur family, and the family of the caliphate. So yes, it's a time of much turmoil. We see the Byzantine Empire just eroding because the Arab armies are kind of going through these countries and taking them over, and mm-hmm. And of course instituting Islamic governments in all of these places. So all of these lands that had been traditionally Christian, really the first Christian lands, were now becoming Muslim lands, or at least were being ruled by the Muslim caliphs.
Dare I say Istanbul, not Constantinople?
In the post-Nicene era?
To quote, they might be giants.
Yeah. Oh, you are hip, Mike.
My son is, anyway.
Yeah. Well, it is a time also in the church where there was a lot of infighting.
That's right. Well, you know, when we talk about theocracy, well, we had our theocracy, and it was the Byzantine Empire. And the emperor at that time was experiencing a lot of difficulty, of course, because he was losing these lands in the east, mm-hmm. and of course he was afraid that he was just going to lose everything, and because the Arabs were experiencing that kind of success, he became convinced that it was because of the use of icons, that there was this idolatry, this incipient idolatry in the worship of the Byzantines, mm-hmm. and a lot of people think it's because his theologians had come under the influence of Islamic theologians.
Mm.
And there's an absolute prohibition on images in Islam.
That's right.
So the Emperor Leo took on this absolute idea about the prohibition of images, and he began first to restrict them, to restrict their use in public places, and then really to have this hysterical reaction when the people resisted that, because
right.
nobody wanted to give up their favorite images, and there was an outcry against it, and the Western Church of course resisted it too, and the Pope opposed him on this. So Leo really had to dig in, and he arranged some councils and that were really these robber councils, these trumped up councils that would condemn the use of icons. He had the icons removed from many places. And as a result, we don't have many images, sacred images, from that period of church history. The only ones that survived were the ones that were beyond the frontiers of the Byzantine Empire, the ones that were in the Islamic lands, really, where they were protected from the laws of the Byzantine Empire during this time.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of turmoil, a lot of bad ideas running around, and John had to find a theological response to this, and he did.
And I think we need to put ourselves in that place, because these images were not just pictures for people to decorate their walls. These were sacred objects that spoke to them in a very strong way, because they were not necessarily a literate community. They didn't read books. They didn't have those types of ways of expressing their faith. I mean,
that's true. And often they learned the faith through the preaching, through the hymns. Also, and maybe especially through those images that were mm-hmm. in the churches that portrayed all of the great events of salvation history, and put them in touch with the figures of salvation history and the heavenly figures, the angels that were watching over them, and really encouraged them to pray that way. It gave them something to connect with.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is a kind of elitism behind it. It's a kind of abstraction of Christianity, and it really is a reversal of the incarnation. It's almost a denial of the incarnation, because it's steering the faithful away from that bodily, that embodiment of the divine, and really imposing on them this transcendence. Now this, of course, is the issue that we see Pope Benedict bringing up now when he talks about that absolute transcendence of the Islamic concept of God, mm-hmm. and asking, Does God even transcend things like reason, you know? And John was dealing with these ideas way back then.
Right around the same area of the world, too.
Yes, the same area of the world. But yeah, John's response to all this was important not only for the restoration of icons to the churches. And the icons really had always been used in churches, and Eusebius records their use very early on. When we go to Rome, we're going to go down into the catacombs and see a lot of sacred images that were used at a very early date in the church's history, long before John of Damascus or Leo the Isaurian. These go way back. John had a response to it, and he put it all in terms of the theology of the Incarnation. And John's response is even used in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. But I hope you don't mind if I just quote a little bit.
Oh, please do.
He says, in former times, and there he's talking about the Old Testament, in former times, God, being without form or body, could in no way be represented. Mm-hmm. But today, since God has appeared in the flesh and lived among men, I can represent what is visible in God.
Mm-hmm.
I do not worship matter, but I worship the creator of matter, who became matter for my sake, and who through matter accomplished my salvation. Never will I cease to honor the matter which brought about my salvation. He's asking us to consider the fact that the Word became flesh, and to consider what the consequences of that are. The consequences are that we can look upon him, as St. John says. You know, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have heard, you know, that is the great thing about the incarnation of the Word. The God who transcends everything chose to become immanent, chose to live in the same world as us and pitch his tent among us. John was so caught up in this that he wanted to sing, and he wanted to look upon it, and he wanted us all to do that. So anyway, I'm getting carried away.
Well, I can't wait to see those images, because I think that it's a way of our expressing that sacred.
It is. You know, that's how we evoke the divine. That's how we contemplate the divine. When we think of God as a father, well, what does a father do with small children? You kind of scratch your head and you think of how are you going to communicate with these children? And really, you go down and you communicate with them in their language. You talk baby talk to them. You draw pictures for them, and you draw simple pictures for them, so that they can see very clearly what's going on. And that's what God condescended to do in the Incarnation. That's what a father does, you know, stoops down to lift up his children. And the images are so important a part of that. They're our affirmation of God's fatherhood and God's method of fatherhood, God's condescension, and God's method of teaching, really. So there's so much we deny when we deny images in worship. And anyway, St. John, when he's talking about this, he takes so many different angles on it. And in the one case, as you bring up, he says this is class warfare. It's war on the poor who can't afford to study philosophy and philosophical theology the way you're doing it. You're denying them the simplicity of their devotion, and you're denying them their only way of contemplating the events in the life of our Lord. But John also took very seriously the prohibitions of images in the Old Testament, and he addressed each of them one by one. He took the arguments very seriously, and he acknowledged that God does prohibit the use of images in worship in the Old Testament. But he goes on to say that if you look through the entire Old Testament, you find that elsewhere he's commanding the use of images in worship.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the temple in Jerusalem, there were all the figures from nature that were on the screen before the Holy of Holies. There were images in different places in the temple, and this was commanded by God. And we also find that in the Old Testament that the patriarchs themselves would honor the staff of a person or even the body of a person by bowing down. This isn't something new. But John says that what we're doing now, he made a crucial distinction between the kind of honor we pay to these images and the kind of honor we give only to God. We worship only God, but we honor these other things, and we honor the image of God. We honor the icons the way we would honor each other human beings, because they are the image of God. All of these things are caught up together. John knew that, and he put out the argument in such a way that other people could understand it too.
I think he really speaks for a whole group of people today in the Catholic Church who, well, it really happened more 20-some years ago when new designs for new churches were coming out, and they were more of a Cistercian type of model where it was very bare.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the theology and all that has been that the people are the color and they should be the pictures. And it's true, but what works for contemplative communities where that austerity is something that speaks to their spirituality, for the average pew person who goes to church on a Sunday and needs to be lifted up in so many ways, taking those images and all of those types of things out of the churches really hurt them at their core.
It did. It impoverished their imagination. And the imagination is an important part of the spiritual life. It's one of the things that we're sanctifying. It's part of what it means to be human. And that, too, God wants to lift up. And that, too, he chose to lift up through the incarnation of his only Son. So, you know, you go to church in any of these kind of lavishly and sometimes over-decorated church of, with all these images, and after Mass, you notice that people go and they go to different images where they have their favorite devotions. You know, some people will go to the Divine Mercy image. Some people will go to a Marian image, and they will then, you know, continue what makes them unique as a Christian, what makes them individual, the thing that is tugging at their heart. And those images in the churches create the condition of possibility for that kind of rich devotion that we associate with Catholic culture. It's not just this austere uniformity that we're going to impose on you from above, but it's this beautiful, just multicolored devotion that arises from below, from the people, and it's just what arises spontaneously from their hearts.
It is what we are as Catholics. I mean, it embraces all of our, you know, our minds, our hearts. We love the smells, the bells. But those images, I don't think they detract from what's happening at the altar. I mean, it's almost like being surrounded by the saints. You're
right.
Part of a huge communion.
Right, right. And again, we owe it to John.
Yeah.
He didn't live to see his doctrine prevail. As a matter of fact, shortly after his death, he was condemned by one of these trumped-up councils, and he was called all kinds of nasty and even foul names, using profanity, in the documents of this robber council. But, of course, eventually there came an empress who just made the unilateral decision that enough is enough, and she changed the policy. Then it was one of the councils at Nicaea that really established it, set it in stone as doctrine of the church that images were to be venerated, and it was that way for centuries afterwards. And it wasn't until the Protestant Reformation that we see another kind of eruption of the iconoclastic tendency in a group of Christians.
Oh, I know what they did to some of those churches in Germany and in England, and oh my goodness,
they were sacked. And of course, in England, Henry VIII himself led the charge in some of these places.
Oh well, but we have so much to, you know, again, to thank John of Damascus. I wish I had an icon of him.
They're available.
Yeah,
they're
gonna have to find one. I'm gonna have to find one.
Yeah. Yes, there. I saw some at St. Isaac of Syria Skeet online, and I don't remember the URL for their website, but that's an Orthodox monastery, and they do have icons of St. John.
Yeah, it seems as though if you're going to have icons around, you should have one of him.
Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor, Chris McGregor, and Mike Aquilina.